Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The throng of thousands that stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6 included devotees of QAnon. That's a conspiracy theory group that got its start in the shadowy corners of the internet. The ideology spread quickly in an online environment with few guardrails and ignited the QAnon movement that helped incite the rioters. Since then, Twitter and other social media platforms have removed thousands of accounts, but users are flocking to news sites such as Gab and Telegraph, which have amassed thousands of new users in the last 2 weeks. Washington Post tech reporter Drew Harwell has been covering this story. A link to his most recent article is posted on our website. Welcome back, Drew.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, just as I was getting ready to launch this hour, I read the headline in the Washington Post: QAnon adherents discussed posing as National Guard to try to infiltrate inauguration, according to FBI intelligence briefing. I mean, the beat goes on, right?
That's right. They don't go away. Even, you know, they've been setting for years this timeline in which Trump, you know, takes power, vanquishes his enemies, maintains a second term. Obviously, none of that is happening, right? I mean, we're in the last hours of Trump's term. And yet the believers in this total hoax are still just as animated, just as energized, and potentially just as dangerous to the people among us who live in reality.
Yeah, and a lot of us, I mean, it took me a while to, you know, for the QAnon conspiracy theory to sink in as far as that it was what it was. We sort of remember, you know, the guy who raided the pizza parlor in Washington, and it was like, well, where did this come from? Why are people saying this? So give us, that was way back when Hillary Clinton was running for president, was a Democratic nominee for president. So give us a thumbnail about what QAnon, what the hoax is, and then why do people believe it?
Yeah, so what you bring up is Pizzagate, and that is the genesis, really, of QAnon. Pizzagate, of course, said a lot of the same things, which was that, you know, Hillary Clinton and all of these top-level Democrats were actually horrible Satanists, you know, child traffickers. Of course, none of it is true, but, you know, it was all this online just hoax until somebody came with a rifle into a pizzeria in DC and fired the weapon. And, you know, so we see that move from online into the real world of this violent talk. But I mean, yeah, conspiracy theories are as old as time in the US, right? They are nothing new, but we are definitely seeing something about the internet, something about social media, these places where people can organize, rally, you know, build narratives that is just core of the internet. And so you're seeing stuff like Pizzagate and QAnon develop. QAnon is a lot like Pizzagate. And you know, what it says is that, of course, Trump is this messianic warrior figure who's fighting against the deep state. Everybody's aligned against them. And also they're all, you know, these Satan worshiping, child eaters, really. And, you know, so it's this good versus evil, almost spiritual battle. And, you know, if you believe in this kind of thing, you don't just believe in this hoax. What it does for you is that it validates all of your prior hatred of the other side. It makes it so it's not just a disagreement over policy. It's that my side is fighting for what's good and right in this world. And the other side, everybody who I disagree with, is actually as evil as you can imagine. So we're seeing QAnon have that space in the real world. And we're seeing those crazy militant ideas actually fester.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Drew Harwell. He's a technology reporter for The Washington Post, and we're talking about the role of social media, of the internet, in the perpetuation of patently false, crazy conspiracy theories, and how they're entering now into the real world. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The internet and social media has a way of presenting itself as if it was, you know, whatever the website might be, as if it's some kind of reliable source. Often, though, when I go to these sites, they only have first names for whatever, who's ever writing. You don't know who the identity is. You don't know who's vetted the information. There's no you know, at least when somebody at the Washington Post or the New York Times gets busted for faking something, it's they lose their job, they're pilloried. You know, there's, it's a horrible thing, and it's very well publicized. I'm wondering about people's reliance on the internet as a source of information. Where that comes from? Is it just people who grew up without newspapers on the kitchen counter in the morning?
Possibly. You know, I think the core of it is a distrust in the media, a distrust in a lot of institutions. But, you know, the feeling among these people that the press doesn't speak for me, they're all liberal or they're all urban or whatever, and they don't represent who I am. And so if you start from that kernel, you start to see, okay, the baseline of mainstream discussion is just totally, they're totally tuned out to it. And so you'll see that they go onto these places like 8kun, where QAnon lives, and they will just believe whatever anonymous stuff people say. And, you know, I don't think it's that they're all crazy, right? It's that they have this deep distress and they're yearning for answers. And finally, they see an answer that is not just, you know, not just helps them feel more self-righteous about the enemies they've already created. But it also, you know, a part of QAnon is that they always say, like, do your own research. And what they mean by do your own research is watch more QAnon YouTube videos, read more QAnon posts, get deeper into the rabbit hole of this belief system. And so for these people, they really do feel like, oh, I'm doing my work. You know, I'm expanding my own mind and informing myself. And yet what they don't realize is that they're really just pouring more poison into their brain. It's just totally not factual. And so, but you start to understand that these people, their intent is really to understand more about the world. But because these places on the internet are so unreliable and so based off outrage and falsehoods, that they end up going deeper into this just totally ludicrous idea about the world.
After the January 6th attack on the Capitol, social media companies kicked thousands of conspiracy theory sites off their platforms, including QAnon. So from what I understand, QAnon's been picked up by some kind of Russian-backed organization. What's going on there?
What happened is there's a website called Parler that sort of framed itself as a kind of a Twitter light, but a Twitter without moderation, a Twitter without, you know, in their words, people trying to tell you what to think. So it became this refuge for all kinds of mostly right-wing believers, where they could go and they could, you know, make fun of Kamala Harris, they could exalt Trump, do whatever they want. So Parler became, you know, not just a political discussion board, but even in the days before the riot on January 6th, we saw and were writing about how many violent threats and just crazy organizing was being done there. So in the aftermath of the riots, Parler was removed from the Apple and Google app stores, which is a kiss of death for any app in the modern world. Mm-hmm. But even worse, they were sort of pulled off of Amazon Web Services. Amazon's cloud effectively runs most of the internet. A lot of the websites you go onto, you don't even realize that they're on Amazon's cloud. And I do have to say, Amazon was founded by Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, right, pays my salary, but I write critically about Amazon as well. And, you know, in this place, what happened was Parler was panned by all of the functional American business elite. So they were effectively knocked online for, I think, you know, some valid reasons. I mean, they were effectively helping organize these violent attacks. So now Parler, we're starting to see inklings of Parler trying to return to the internet. They have a scrap of what their previous website was. It's not even really anything you can use. It just says sort of, watch this space, we'll be back. But Parler is now sort of supported by this Russian company that helps protect websites from going offline again. So you see, you know, we talk about deplatforming, you know, removing Trump from Twitter, removing QAnon people from Twitter. And all of that is sort of helpful because you won't see it on Twitter anymore, but there's always a place on the internet for somebody to go. The internet is just distributed enough that it's never really possible to extinguish an idea outright.
Okay, so Twitter on Sunday locked the account of U.S. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia for promoting these baseless QAnon theories. Where's the Twitter line of demarcation when it comes to lies and conspiracy theories and free speech? And how in the world do they police that anyway?
It's changing all the time. And actually, Twitter was very permissive for years.
Yeah.
And they allowed a lot of, garbage on the site for years because, you know, and we'd asked, Jack, who runs Twitter, why not shut down some of this crazy conspiracy theory, violent garbage? Why not shut down Trump, who is, you know, actively promoting and encouraging this stuff for years? And the argument was always, we're not going to silence the newsmakers who run our government. It's up, you know, and their reason, you know, I think this is a valid idea that a lot of people can back, is that people deserve to hear what their elected representatives have to say.
Uh-huh.
And so they gave, you know, Trump wide leavings and other lawmakers just they very hands-off treatment. But, you know, they've started to change that, especially as some of this stuff has gone from outside the online kind of rabble rousing to actual real world violence. And with Trump, they said finally after the January 6th riots, where he was extremely slow to say anything about the rioters who had actually breached the Capitol, and even then was still saying that Biden's win was illegitimate, Twitter finally said enough is enough, and they've started to really take a sharper tack. So it's going to be interesting in the coming years, because these websites have already said, we don't want to be the arbiters of truth. We're just a platform on which ideas are shared. But now they're starting to take more responsibility for how can we encourage healthy dialogue on our website and also discourage this violent muck that people are steeped in online.
And that appears to be validated or get validation by its very existence on these mm-hmm. sites or on these platforms. Let's see. Yeah. Jason and Logan, you're on the air. Hi, Jason.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. I don't think you're a bad person because you believe parts of QAnon, but I guess the question is, how did you become acquainted with the QAnon theories that have been roundly debunked? And why
well,
do
just
you...
Doing
Yeah.
Doing research into the Freemasons and stuff. I was kind of curious why all these big wigs get together secretly and what they're doing.
Yeah.
And then I hear about people like Jeffrey Epstein, and I hear about people going to Bohemian Grove. What exactly are they doing? And I see a wall at Walmart every time I go there of kids missing. Where are these children? But what they do is they lump me in as an overzealous Christian, which is then they can say, well, you're just an overzealous Christian. That's why you're saying these crazy
Okay, so you, all right, okay, all right. So, Jason, I get it. You have questions. You think there's something wrong out there. Obviously, I agree. Anyone who would look at the wall of missing children would say there's a problem. But why QAnon?
What, it's just an idea.
It's just an idea. Okay, all right.
If someone says, hey, let's talk about this QAnon thing like we're doing right now, no one's being threatened. No one's using violence. So you're banning an idea. You're banning a conversation. How is that okay?
Okay. How do they justify it in those terms, Drew Harwell?
So, you know, I want to start from the point of caring about missing children, caring about Jeffrey Epstein. These are, you know, these are horrible crimes. And I think people who believe this stuff have the best of intentions, want the truth, want bad people to be punished. Where it crosses the line into, you know, these companies starting to ban it is when it starts to talk about, you know, and part of QAnon is this, you know, violent movement. I mean, saying that Trump is going to throw his enemies into Guantanamo Bay thing, you know, with adherents sort of saying we need to topple the government and get to the real core of the issue. And that will involve punishing, you know, Hollywood elites and, you know, liberal politicians. So, you know, if it was just kind of this idle chatter and sort of, you know, conspiracy theory, like what could happen, man on the moon stuff, mm-hmm. it would be one thing. But we've crossed a line, and not saying that the caller has been involved in this, but we've crossed a line to where some of the QAnon conversation online really is discussing organized violence. And we saw even before the Capitol riots where people, you know, people on these QAnon forums were sharing, you know, maps of the tunnels in the Capitol and how can we break in and which windows should we break. So that is the line that the tech companies have decided. That's the Rubicon we can't cross. And they've said that this real world violence cannot play. We cannot allow that anymore.
And you interviewed Joel Finkelstein of the Network Contagion Research Institute, and he predicted more to come.
Yeah, and that's been the fear. You know, it's always hard to know online whether people are discussing this in kind of just a, whether this is just sort of idle talk or whether this is sort of real world danger here. And before the Capitol, I think that was probably a reason why law enforcement was caught so flat-footed. They didn't realize that a lot of this stuff was actually going to be playing out in the real world. But now people are starting to take this talk seriously. And there is a realization that even if most of the people who are talking about it online do nothing, there will be people who do something, who take this as a call to action. So, you know, the fear is that we've got the inauguration this week. You know, there are going to be protests at potentially at state capitals across the country. You really do worry if people do believe the most militant theories online and do believe that they're in a righteous battle of good versus evil, that they could take matters into their own hands and do something violent that could hurt people. So yeah, the fear is that this is not something that's going away anytime soon.
Well, Drew Harwell, we'll talk about it again, I'm sure. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Drew Harwell is technology reporter for The Washington Post. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is called the cuffing season, that period from November to February when singles look to couple up for the winter. And thanks to the pandemic, the number of people looking for love or at least companionship is off the charts. And it's not limited to the winter months. From March to May last year, the online dating app OkCupid saw a 700% increase in dates. Its competitor, Bumble, saw a 70% increase in video calls. And with all of that, these apps collect a lot of personal data. Caitlin Chin is a research analyst at the Brookings Institution. It's a nonprofit public policy institute based in Washington, D.C. A link to a recent study she co-authored on dating apps and privacy is posted on our website. Welcome to the show, Caitlin Chin.
Thank you for having me.
The dating apps collect a bunch of information, personally identifiable information, other than the obvious name and age stuff. What else are they finding out about the people who use it?
Absolutely. I mean, dating apps can collect your age, gender, sexual orientation, swipe history, location, even photos and messages. So in short, dating apps can collect anything that a user puts into the app knowingly or unknowingly.
So swipe history, photos, messages, that is really personal stuff. That's you interacting actually with the app. What is the concern about the app having that? Because I kind of think, well, no duh. I mean, if you're doing it on the app, they're collecting the data.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think some of the concerns are, I mean, if we just look at the type of app, like data that's being collected, but then we also have to take a look at the volume of data that's being collected. Like you mentioned, since the pandemic began, especially during cuffing season, the amount of data that dating apps and websites are collecting has just really skyrocketed over the past few years. And the issue is that dating apps and websites haven't changed their privacy policies in recent years. And also, the United States doesn't have sufficient privacy legal protections to protect dating app users from any potential harms that may occur. Harms that could include stalking, doxing, blackmail. So there really are really real risks that could come from the amount of data and the type of data collected by these apps.
And that's predicated on the idea that somebody could hack.
Predicated on the idea that somebody could hack, but then also the data that apps and websites collect and knowingly share with third parties, such as marketers, advertisers, or anybody else.
And when you talk about the privacy policies, I mean, my first impulse would say, well, if they share that data, I mean, are they also connecting the dots for the third party?
It's It's definitely possible. I mean, a lot of the data that's being collected, age, gender, sexual orientation, this is personally identifiable information that could be linked back to the original user, especially if it's combined or aggregated with other information. I would say another concern as well is how exactly the third parties are using this information.
Yeah.
Often this isn't transparent. This isn't something, this information can be used in ways that dating app users may not expect or predict.
How would hypothetically a privacy policy be updated to reflect the current volume?
Yeah, and I would say, first of all, many privacy policies are very loose and relaxed. Dating apps and websites know that most people just don't read privacy policies. And for understandable reasons, they can be lengthy, they're confusing, and often users don't have any choice other than to accept the privacy policy in order to use a service. So when we take a look at privacy policies from common dating apps and websites like Tinder or Bumble, these companies will very plainly state that anything you submit in the app can eventually become public. They'll state that we share your data, we collect your data. So I would say the first major change that would need to be made is for dating apps to set clear rules about what types of data they can collect, who they can share it with, and how long they retain this data. But unfortunately, there are very little incentives for dating apps to voluntarily do this. I mean, many people don't read privacy policies, and if other dating apps aren't making these changes, why should they?
And there's no public push at this point Congress has done literally nothing on this score.
Right. That's a good way to put it, I think, Anne. So over the past couple of years, and I think especially after, I'm not sure if you remember the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal that happened a few years ago, there has been a lot of interest in Congress on privacy legislation. But unfortunately, that interest hasn't yet translated into a passable law. Many members of Congress have introduced bills that would provide enhanced privacy protections for Americans, including people who use dating apps. But unfortunately, none of these bills have yet seen any progress over the past couple years.
And what do you attribute that lack of progress to? You're more diplomatic than I am. I mean, to me, it's what's the bottom line is nothing at this point. But why?
Yeah, I mean, I would say in one word, politics. Mm. I mean, it's been pretty difficult for Democrats and Republicans to come to agreement on a lot of bills, and unfortunately, that includes privacy. But I think also the current situation in the United States has sort of made any chance of privacy legislation passing worse. With the pandemic, with so many other priorities in Congress, I think privacy has sort of taken a backseat, especially even more so over the past year, which is really unfortunate because I think the pandemic actually has made privacy legislation even more urgent, as so much of our lives have, I guess, gone remote, including for many people, work, school, mm-hmm. even dating. We really need to be thinking about privacy now.
And so for people who maybe are having a hard time wrapping their brain around all of this, more LGBTQ plus adults use online dating websites and apps than ever before. And Grindr, an LGBTQ plus dating app, allows users to share their HIV status. It ran into trouble doing that in 2018. What happened in that case?
Right. So I guess in 2018, Grindr actually admitted to having a security flaw that would allow people, so external parties, to potentially, see the locations of users. And I think Grindr is also, it's also a unique case because Grindr actually collects users' HIV statuses and most recent test dates. So this is very sensitive personal information. And in 2018, Grindr acknowledged that it had shared users' HIV status with third-party companies. And then I guess about a year ago, the Norwegian Consumer Council released a report that also found that Grindr was currently sharing user tracking information, and as well as sexual orientation and precise location history with external marketers. So these are very serious privacy concerns, and I think it's something that not many users are aware of or could even reasonably expect.
When it comes to laws that dictate how companies may collect and share information, it's a patchwork across the country. Congress has left it to the states. A lot of states, just like Congress, have done basically nothing. California, predictably, like many things, is out in front on the issue. What does that portend once California goes that way? So goes New York State, then, you know, and then the usuals fall in line. But what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's what they say, right? So goes California, goes the nation, I think. Mm-hmm. I think it's definitely possible that more over the next couple of years, more states will introduce and potentially even pass privacy legislation. Last year, Washington State came pretty close to passing a privacy law, but didn't get there in the end. I think a patchwork of state laws is probably what dating apps and websites want to avoid. They don't want to have to comply with 50 different state laws. I will say this situation isn't ideal as well for dating app users themselves. It introduces a lot of confusion. If you're a dating app user in Maryland and you message someone in Virginia, you know, whose law applies? But then also there's the fact that state by state regulation, it takes a long time to pass. It took almost two decades for all 50 states to pass a law for even requiring companies to notify people of a data breach. And that if it took 20 years to pass a law as simple as that, I don't think dating app users can wait another two decades for privacy laws in all 50 states.
You mentioned things like stalking and that sort of thing. Are there examples of that? Is it just anecdotal, or has there been a trend toward that?
Yeah, so I read a news report a few weeks ago, I think, that talked about a user on a dating app that I guess this person's, I think, ex-partner actually created a fake profile for them and posted photos of the person and essentially impersonated this person and said, and I apologize if this is graphic or I guess essentially said that this person wanted to be sexually assaulted, even though of course he didn't. And the issue is that the dating app did not feel compelled to take down this profile, even though this profile was clearly false. It clearly had very real harms that could come from it. Mm-hmm. I believe that the person was actually stalked in real life because of this fake dating profile. So I think that introduces a lot of concerns, whether that's privacy, content moderation, harassment. So there are real cases, I think, of people either falsely or otherwise, experiencing real life consequences from the lack of privacy protections on dating apps.
You know, the trust that we as a society have in the technology, have in online, how the net works and how everything between from apps and you know, we just got done talking about QAnon and the, you know, the crazy conspiracy theories coming out of that, how it has been fueled by the internet, fueled by the social media apps. It's kind of amazing what people are willing to put out there. Do you understand, or is there studies going on about why people feel? Is it mainly digital natives that are like that, or is it? It didn't look like a lot of digital natives storming the Capitol in Washington on January 6th.
Right, and that's an excellent question, Anne, and something that I would love to research more. I will say I'm sure it's a few reasons, and I think one of them is that people just feel like perhaps they feel this false sense of security on dating apps, but more than that, I feel like often people just have very few other options, and especially now during a pandemic. I mean, now the pandemic has come in and sort of changed how we conduct our daily lives, including dating, and for many people, virtual social interactions is the only way to meet people. Now that we don't go out in person as much, and I think that really says that I guess that dating apps just need to have a clear legal responsibility to protect people's privacy. Like, we can't put the onus on people and tell people, okay, just don't put any information out there. That's not really fair to them, because dating apps have just become the new norm now during the pandemic, but even before that, people were trending toward dating apps.
Well, I'm wondering, has there been any litigation on this score? Sometimes things change because the courts change them.
Yeah. So dating apps, I think, have been sort of an untested area in court. There have been plenty of court cases on privacy, plenty of court cases about stalking relationships, but dating apps have become more popular over the past few years. So the history isn't as long, but I think also it's very difficult to bring litigation as a dating app user. I think a part of the reason for that is because the lack of transparency. Like, if an app is collecting your data and sharing your data and selling your data, if you're a dating app user, you really have no way to know. So I think it's not only is it hard to know if your privacy is being violated, but it's even harder to bring a lawsuit also because of the current privacy laws that we have.
It's the forensics of it is difficult to uncover.
Right. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Well, Caitlin Chin, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me, Anne.
You bet. That's Caitlin Chin. She is a research analyst at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and we've been talking about dating apps and all the information that they gather every time you use it. Just beware. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. We'll be right back on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is a new year still. Seems kind of old at this point, but it's new. And a new rollout of tech gear on the heels of the all-virtual Consumer Electronics Show. Samsung has launched the Samsung Galaxy S21, another brilliantly named device. Here to tell us more about the new phone is Russell Holley, contributing editor of Android Central. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Okay, so again, another brilliantly named phone. I mean, there are I don't even know how people keep track of the phone. I mean, that's what you do for, you know, that's what they pay you for. But how do people distinguish from all the choices? What's your sense about how normal people do that?
So I think what it really comes down to is folks, you know, we used to here in the U.S. Upgrade every 2 years in that, you know, your Verizon bill would come up and say, hey, you know, you're due for an upgrade. You can go in and do that. You know, that system doesn't exist for everyone anymore because we've kind of shifted to being able to pay for your phone separately and not having it be a part of your phone bill. But I still think that there's a ton of people in America who go into their you know, cellular store, you know, their carrier of choice when the phone isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing anymore. And they kind of say, you know, I need a new version of this. And that's more or less what they end up getting. There isn't a whole lot of evidence that suggests that, like, people jump back and forth between, you know, Apple and Samsung or, you know, Google. Or they usually go in and say, I know this thing. I like this thing. Can I have the newest version of this thing? And that's usually what the salesperson does, is they set them up with that thing. So this phone is for, you know, people who were excited about their last Samsung phone that they got probably 3 years ago. They know that they can go and they've paid off their existing phone. They want to come in and get a new one. And that's what these phones are now here for.
Okay, so what kind of upgrade is the Samsung Galaxy S21?
The Samsung Galaxy S21 comes in three different forms. And so it's really about the kind of upgrade that you are most interested in. If you just need something that is the, you know, just kind of a refreshed version of what you have right now, the Samsung Galaxy S21 in kind of its standard version is a smallish phone that comes in a couple of different colors. It has some really nice cameras on the back. The screen is spectacular. And the software is pretty similar to what you were already using on your phone. So the buttons are all going to more or less be in the same place. You'll have a few new features. But the big thing there is the camera and the battery are both going to be really, really good.
And there's no charger?
So there is a cord in the box that will connect your phone to whatever accessory you have in the house.
Okay.
But it does not come with that other accessory, the thing that plugs into the wall. And Apple did the same thing earlier this year, where they, or last year rather, where they released the phone, but it didn't come with the charging brick in the box. Apple and Samsung both argue that most people have those things. But the counter to that is that if you are someone who does not have those things, you cannot just request one for free. You have to pay the extra, you know, 10 or 15 bucks to get one, which naturally increases the price of your phone. So I don't enjoy this particular move from Apple and Samsung. I think it's a pretty bad idea, for especially for people who upgrade every 3 or 4 years. Those charging bricks that you have at home don't actually charge as fast as the ones that were would come in the box even last year. They charge much faster. So, you know, charging people for that while your phone price remains roughly the same is really very clearly more of a, you know, kind of craven cost saving measure on your part, and not something that you're doing to help the environment, like Apple and Samsung claim.
Never would accuse them of cravenly trying to
giant tech companies
generate
not at all.
More revenue. So the built-in lenses, you mentioned the camera, that sounds like it's competing with Apple toe-to-toe.
Well, yeah, it actually depends on which version of the phone you want. If you want the Samsung Galaxy S21 has three cameras in the back, and so that gets you kind of your standard shooting lens that you have, you know, for everything. And then it has a lens that will zoom in 2x so that you can catch something further away without having to kind of stretch the image like you would before with pinch to zoom. And then it has a wide lens for if you're catching, you know, a beautiful sunrise or you know, a large group of people or something like that. That wide lens is not quite as good as the other cameras as far as like image quality, but it allows you to capture a much wider image, which can be super helpful. That's the Samsung Galaxy S21, the standard version. But because Samsung and Apple both have decided to start making significantly more impressive versions of their phones that you can pay extra for, there is a Samsung Galaxy S21 Ultra, and it does not have three lenses in the back. It actually has five.
Holy moly.
It has the back of this phone kind of looks like half of a spider. And the and you can capture quite a bit more material with this. The lenses allow you to zoom in even further and do some macro stuff. There are some really clever black and white things that can be done with these lenses. They are really designed for someone who captures every possible moment that they can with their phone. And these phones are designed to store, you know, a great deal more as far as video goes as well.
Yeah, the battery is the storage capabilities much better.
There's an increased storage when you get the Ultra version of the phone that allows you to store a lot more, which is important because, you know, the front facing camera on this is also huge on the Galaxy Ultra. They wanted to make sure that you were taking the highest possible quality selfies, and that's a thing that is very important. So your front camera is also 40 megapixels, which is just genuinely massive for something that goes on the front of your camera. It's not something that many other companies are doing right now, but if it works for them, then it's something that we will probably see Apple do within the next year or two.
Because if that's with the Ultra or Deluxe or whatever it is, or
that's right, yeah, the Ultra version,
right? Okay, the S21 is an incredibly priced phone slash camera slash whatever, $200.
Well, sort of. This is a phone that you can get for $200 if you have a reasonable trade-in, and if you're getting it through a carrier right now, there are a lot of deals that you can use to get a hold of it.
Okay.
The phone, if you're just buying it outright, is actually going to be $800.
Okay.
Which is still less expensive than you would see, you know, from a ton of other places. And the trade-in program that Samsung has is actually quite good. If you have a phone that's within the last year or two, you can get a pretty great credit in order to you know, put a down payment on this phone. But the big thing there is going to be, you know, people who walk into a store a month from now and say that they want to get this phone, their out-of-pocket total is going to be around $800 for this version. And then if you want the Ultra version of this phone, it will increase by about $300.
And there's a writing curse, or whatever you call it, a pen for this phone.
It has an accessory that allows you to do this. And this is something that Samsung has never done before. Previously, if you wanted a Samsung phone that had a stylus in it, you had to buy the Samsung Galaxy Note. And the problem with the Samsung Galaxy Note for people like me is that the phone is gigantic and I don't like having a giant phone in my pocket. I don't like walking around with it to type because it's bigger than my hand and I'm going to drop it. And I don't like using pop sockets. So there's a case now that you can buy from Samsung that will clip onto the side of the case, the side of your phone, and has a small indentation on the side that actually stores the stylus as though it were the Samsung Galaxy Note, meaning that this stylus tech is now available to anyone who buys a Samsung phone, which is good. There's a ton of features that come with that, but it also probably means that Samsung will not need the Galaxy Note in the next year or two. And so we may see them move on to something else.
Well, we know they're going to move on to something. So
that's true. Yeah, they will replace it with something. It will not go away.
Change is the one constant. Apple is reportedly preparing a subscription podcast service. Bloomberg has reported this, citing unnamed sources, that Apple's adding this service to its podcasting business at some point. And that's awful vague. What does it mean to normal podcast consumers?
Well, that's a great question. And this is kind of a continuing conversation that we've had over the past couple of weeks, is Apple and Amazon have started buying other companies that have, you know, popular podcast networks and kind of making them exclusive to those networks. This is kind of the next logical step for the company to say, you know, you can come and get all of these great podcasts from us and we will charge you this, you know, $2 or $3 a month to have access to all of these podcasts. And in bonuses, you'll be able to get them without advertising, or you'll be able to get them without, you know, kind of personal data sharing or anything like that. But you pay that you know, that small monthly fee so that the people who create the podcast get paid in this different way.
Mm-hmm. No advertising. What's your sense about that?
I think it's going to be very complicated. I think that the one really great thing about podcasts right now is that anybody can listen to them from a variety of different applications. Doesn't really matter if you're on a computer, if you're on a phone, if you're on a watch, there are ways to consume podcasts. And that gets a lot more challenging if Amazon and Spotify and Apple all have different subscription services in order to access all of these podcasts. I'm concerned about a future in 2 or 3 years where like a single app is not enough in order to listen to all these podcasts anymore.
So are you saying that when they create these subscription services that they won't be available otherwise?
Historically, Apple has done exactly that. If you look at the Apple Games subscription service, there are games that you can only get if you have the subscription service. You can't just buy that game from the App Store and then play it. You only have access to those games if you are part of the subscription. And this is something that they've done with television. It's something they've done with fitness. It would make sense if it follows their current business model for them to launch a service like this and then say, this content is only accessible if you pay us. And that almost assuredly comes with if you pay us and then use our application.
So it becomes the haves and the have-nots.
It certainly could be if, you know, we know that Spotify has been considering something similar and Amazon has already started buying other companies. It genuinely seems like there is a foreseeable future here where you don't have the ability to listen to every podcast that you want through just one app, and you'd end up having to pay Netflix style subscriptions for them.
And the universe of podcasts now is so expanded.
It's massive.
It's massive. I mean, but is there any sense about what that universe of content creators thinks about this?
Yeah, I mean, so there's been some positive and negative feedback here. On the one hand, you know, a single person who has a podcast that is very popular, it's difficult to manage business relations and spend time, you know, creating advertising and doing things like that. Being able to offload that sort of thing to Amazon or to Apple so that you could just focus on doing the cool, you know, making the podcast parts, I can see that being very appealing because these are often not large companies. These are two or three people who happen to have time, and the podcast just got popular and started making money. So they had to, you know, think about it with a more business head. Being able to offload some of that weight to these bigger companies, I can see that being appealing. At the same time, you're limiting your potential audience. You know, there are a lot of people who will not pay for these services. The whole reason that they enjoy podcasts in the first place is that they are free and they can listen to them on a jog, and it doesn't require, you know, work in order to enjoy that material. I can see that you know, having some negative side effects.
Right, right. Once you have to start paying for it, then that automatically makes it work. Asus has made another laptop that comes with two screens. A laptop that, how does that even work? Do they fold out?
No. So this was the coolest thing from last year that nobody knows about. It's kind of a running joke here, is that Asus made this massive gaming laptop last year where just above the keyboard, there was this large display that actually tilted up a little bit. So you had the normal laptop screen, and then just below it was this other screen that kind of tilted up and gave you a second screen. And it was really strange, but it was a lot of fun to use. And it was the kind of thing where if you were playing a lot of video games, you could have kind of important messages and stuff down on the bottom, or if you just were a heavy multitasker, then you could enjoy this. But the computer was almost $2,000. It was prohibitively expensive for a lot of people. And so Asus, even though it was expensive, it was popular enough that Asus has rolled out this technology into other laptops, the most recent of which being what's called the ZenBook Duo 14, which is considerably less expensive at $1,700 and just is a lot more compact, but has the same basic technology where you open up the laptop screen and you've got your keyboard and your trackpad off to the side, and then a large secondary display that you can tilt up and use however you see fit.
So when you say large secondary display, if it's a 14-inch laptop, is it popping up and you can just pop it up and down as you choose?
That's right. Yeah, you can tilt it up and down. If you are sitting somewhere where you're kind of, you know, hunched over your screen, then you don't have to, you know, it can stay flat. And it goes the entire width of the laptop, you know. So you've got this, it's an odd shape for a screen because it's quite you know, it's not very tall,
right.
It's quite wide. So you're only using it for, you know, kind of small things like, you know, chat windows and things like that, or maybe a video that you wanted to play in kind of a smaller form. But otherwise, you would have everything kind of up in this larger screen. It's actually quite useful for Zoom because you can have kind of the bar of people talking down at the bottom, and you can kind of focus on the stuff that's on the screen if you're presenting something.
Yeah.
You know, for example, so it has a couple of pretty interesting uses, but it is quite unusual to look at.
I just see anything like this seems to be it was good timing on their part, because more people are using their laptops than ever because of working from home.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a great opportunity for people who, you know, are used to having a desk in the office that has kind of their laptop and then a secondary screen, but don't really have enough room for that at home.
Yeah.
Because they're in smaller apartments or something like that. This kind of machine would be perfect for them.
You said, what is it? $1,700, did you say?
Yeah, this is a $1,700 laptop, which is, like I said, it's $400 to $500 less expensive than the original version of this. So it's good to see that they are intentionally kind of making this available to more people.
What else do you like about it?
A great laptop. LG has done a really good job recently making laptops that are nice and light without compromising a lot in the way of power. Because you have two different screens here, you're going to have slightly less battery just because you have two screens that are drawing from the battery.
Yeah.
So you don't have an all-day laptop here like you would with a comparably priced, you know, MacBook or Surface, but you're getting quite a bit more out of it. So I really enjoy the design, but also it's light enough, even though it has two screens, that I can toss it into a bag and comfortably take it nowhere because I don't leave the house right now, but eventually take it other places.
You can pre-order.
Sometimes I like to put my laptop in a bag and then go to the other room just to feel like I've done something.
You can pre-order it this month. What do you expect the reaction is going to be to it?
I think this is going to be pretty positive, but I also think this is the kind of thing that is best seen in person before purchasing. And so I wonder, you know, with fewer and fewer people kind of walking into Best Buys and Walmarts and things like that to shop for technology right now, I'm curious if seeing pictures and video of it will be enough for people.
And we just have about 30 seconds, but I am curious about the Consumer Electronics Show and what if it was the online, you know, virtual slog you were worried it would be.
It was definitely complicated. You know, I ran into a lot of the concerns that I kind of predicted that I would run into. There were a lot of companies that I didn't hear or see anything about until after the show, when I'm kind of going through my email and see things. And I went, man, I wish I had talked to those people.
Yeah.
So in one way, it's interesting because I can kind of continue that conversation over the next couple of weeks. But, you know, it's obviously not the same presentation that they would have had before. So yeah, I think that smaller organizations were definitely negatively impacted by doing all of this virtually, but it seems like these companies are pretty interested in keeping in touch with folks. So maybe it won't be, you know, quite so detrimental as it kind of stretches out over the next couple of weeks.
Well, here's to an in-person CES in 2022.
Yeah.
For now, Russell Holley, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holley, contributing editor at Android Central, joins us every Tech Tuesday. So thanks for that. And thanks to everybody else out there who is listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.